Good Monday morning. Hope your morning is off to a pretty good start so far. 10:06 is the time right now. Hi, and welcome to the second hour of our show. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon, and here's what's ahead on the show for you today. Jupiter flinging asteroids at Earth and the most realistic plant-based steak yet. Two of the topics we'll discuss this hour as we welcome Dr. Rob Thacker to the show for another edition of Science Files, and I'll make the introduction in just a moment. We'll go to the phones next hour. Our first open hour of the week is coming up at 11. We call it Manic Monday, and of course, as always, anything goes. Dow's food professor Sylvain Charlebois will tell us at noon about a panel discussion Thursday evening at the Halifax Central Library. It's about food security. It's open to the public. And again, Dr. Charlebois will tell us more about that. And we'll hear another Halifax History Moment this afternoon with Halifax historian and author Blair Bead. But this hour, time for another edition of Science Files. And joining me in the studio this morning is St. Mary's University astrophysicist, Dr. Rob Thacker. Good morning, Dr. Rob.
Good morning.
And how are you today?
Pretty good. A little bit sore. Down to work out this morning. Yeah. So, raring to go. Let's go.
Bench pressing and squats. You're putting me to shame here. Jeez Louise.
Well, I'd let my wife put you to shame.
Yeah, probably that too. Three squats and I'd be out.
No, she set PBs today.
So is that doing well? Yeah. Good for her. Good for you. Good to work out. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Well, let's go to the phones because Eric's on the line. He wants to ask us a question here this morning. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Rick. I'm curious, George, this morning. Good morning, Dr. Rob.
Good morning.
Dr. Rob, I was watching a documentary the other night, and the presenter was talking about the things that affect Earth's climate. He was talking about precision. Is that the correct word?
Precision versus accuracy, yes.
Yeah, and he said the cycle takes 26,000 years. And what he said was that there's anomalies in this cycle that in the past have caused abrupt climate change, changes in climate. And what struck me curious about that, as you know, Greenland was a much different place in 950 A.D., and I'm wondering if precision could have something to do with the, these kind of changes.
All right. Okay. Appreciate that, Eric. Thank you.
I know exactly what you're talking about, and I should have said precession. That was the word I should have given rather than precision. It's precession. And so,
precession. Okay, thank you.
There is this wobble in the position of the Earth's axis, right? And so that's what this particular 26,000 years, more or less 26,000 year cycle is. And they're called Milankovitch cycles. And they're well understood within the geologic record of what's happened to the climate over a long time. So the short answer is the 26,000 year cycle is obviously a lot longer than 900 years. And there's a huge amount of debate over what Greenland was actually like in the past and whether it was like this whole idea that it was quote unquote green. And that's how it's going
to be. Well, they say the same about
Greenland.
Antarctica, right?
Yeah, but there's actually not much evidence for that. So anyway, but it's a nice idea and it sort of like appeals to how you would get people to go there. But what was much more likely was the Vikings said, oh, it's green, really? Come on, you want to go there? And so encourage people to go. But anyway, So in general, yes, the Milankovitch cycles do exist. Precession is a real thing. It does impact the climate. But the short answer is, on the scale of 1,000 years, it's not going to have that big an impact because the cycle is about 26 times longer than that.
Hmm.
Right. That's the main thing there.
All right. Then.
But yes, it does absolutely have an effect.
Does that answer your question, Eric?
Yeah, and I got a second question, if I may, very quickly. He also stated that in the gravitational situation in the universe that Saturn and Jupiter sometimes can affect Earth's climate. Is there any validity to that?
Not on a gravitational basis. No way.
No? Okay, good. Okay. Right. Well, thank you very much for your time.
All right. Thanks, Eric. Appreciate the call. Yeah. Let's go next to Tom, who's got a question for us on the phone this morning. Hi, Tom.
How are you doing, Rick?
Good. How are you doing today?
Not bad.
Good.
Just a question when it comes to space programs. Mm-hmm. What about water? How much would it actually take for a long-term space program to actually be supported? How much would you need to pull from the planet in order to get it up and running properly, you know, where you can actually have, say, 500,000 people working out in space?
All right.
That is an awesome question because that is one of the single biggest barriers to space exploration, right? So a few things to take into account. When people talk about mining, right, mining asteroids, what they're really talking about is actually mining water.
Really?
Yep. Water can actually do so many things. It's useful for us because we need it to live, right? Mm-hmm. But the first thing to remember is that when you would have sort of like large-scale colonies on other planets, the first thing you would do is improve your recycling of water as much as possible. That happens already on the space station. You still need some because you're still losing a certain amount of water. But that brings the amount that you need down for human activity quite considerably. To put an absolute number on it, I'm really sorry. I would have to go and look up some details and then do some calculations. I can't do that. But it's definitely the case that we still need a non-zero amount of water to survive in other places. We will use water up.
And they think they can get this off asteroids.
Yeah, because really? You have minerals. You had minerals saturated with water, and then you can extract the water out of those. That is a big thing. And then the other amazing thing about water is you can use it as rocket fuel.
Really? Water?
Yeah, once you burn it.
You got to actually separate it into the hydrogen and oxygen. So you got to put energy in to do that. But as long as you have water, you can separate the two of them, and then you have hydrogen plus oxygen, water plus energy.
There you go. Amazing. And so where do we get this water besides asteroids? Is this the water that perhaps we could get from the planet Mars, or is there water on the moon
So the situation with Mars' surface is a lot of that water has actually gone into the minerals on the surface.
Yep.
Right? And so it's there, but it's locked up in these sort of like crystals in the rocks.
Hmm. Tom, does that answer your question?
Yeah. Just one other thing. Polar reversal. How long before the next one?
We don't know. Right? We don't know. We only know the average for how long it takes over a very, very long period of time based upon the geomagnetic record. But the honest answer is we don't know.
Hmm.
Right? You can estimate it based upon the length of the cycle, but that's probably not accurate.
All right. Aren't we overdue for it? By their estimates?
Off the top of my head, I'd have to look it up, right? I think we're close to being due for another one, but I can't remember. And I don't want to say something when I'm not sure.
Okay.
Appreciate the call. Thanks, Tom. Explain that for us, this polar reverse thing.
So the way that the Earth is built, we have in the middle, we have basically a liquid center. It sounds like a chocolate, but it's not. It's, trust me. So it's really, really hot. And as all of the material is circulating around, it's creating a current as it does that. And that current is what eventually leads to a magnetic field being created and so on. But every few sort of like, I think it's something like 50,000 years or something like that, on average, the current actually reverses direction. And so the magnetic field actually flips around and goes from north to south to south to north.
But we wouldn't notice something like that, would we?
Oh, we would notice it because our compasses would go freaky, right? So we would know that was happening. And it has a certain impact on the aurora as well, because as the magnetic field changes, then the aurora are actually going to dump their energy over different parts of the Earth as the pole moves around.
And this magnetic field, what's its purpose in life?
So the magnetic field is an awesome thing because it protects us and everything on the planet from cosmic radiation, right? And so what it does is the magnetic field will funnel charged particles up to the poles or down to the poles if you're in the southern hemisphere, right? And then you get all of that sort of material piling up there and creating these big, beautiful aurora. So if you didn't have that, then what you would have is all of these charged particles coming down to the surface of the Earth and creating significantly more radiation on the Earth.
And that's not good for us.
That's not good, no. So if you go to a planet like Mars, the surface of Mars down to maybe about a foot and a half is actually being irradiated by solar radiation and cosmic rays.
So their magnetic field, obviously, it's
not pretty much gone, right? Mars may have had one in the past, but there was an absolutely wacky, story from NASA who was saying, you know, if we want to make Mars habitable, then we need to put some kind of shield in to actually prevent all of the cosmic rays from the sun hitting the surface.
Is that
possible? They were talking about what you would...
No.
Not with current technology, no way.
That would have to be like, could that just be a small section of Mars? Could you?
So you can shield, right? So you could build like a giant dome or something like that, and then thick enough. That's conceivable. Right?
So, Bill, stay there. You're coming up. We've got phone lines open too. If you've got a question for Dr. Rob here this morning, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. This is Science Files on a Monday morning. We'll be back with more right after this. 10:18, it's a Monday morning. Dr. Rob Thacker with us for Science Files, our weekly look at news from the world of science. And, well, Bill's giving us a call this morning with a question. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Bill.
This may be kind of a stupid question, but, you know, with all the technology we have and so on, and put the man on the moon and all the things we can do, you know, some of these major catastrophes we have in weather and so on, well, just take, I know we can't do much about earthquakes and so on, but I keep wondering about hurricanes, why we can't send something up there to disperse it, something like a low-grade atomic missile or whatever. Is this possible? Why can't we disperse these hurricanes, considering so, all the costs of life and property damage?
They have tried, I believe, have they
well,
not?
Okay. Bill and President Trump. Yeah. So, okay, it's a reasonable question. Like, because nuclear weapons are essentially the most powerful thing that humans have ever created, and so you look at a hurricane and you think to yourself, well, you know, shouldn't a nuclear weapon be able to do something about that? And the short answer is, hurricanes have vastly more energy in them than nuclear weapons do, right? So you could let off a nuclear weapon in a hurricane, and the short answer of what you would do is you would actually end up creating a massive radiation cloud within the hurricane, and the hurricane would keep on going.
Yeah.
So it, unfortunately, Bill, it just doesn't work. There's just so much more power in a hurricane, you wouldn't believe it compared to a nuclear weapon.
And our means of controlling any kind of weather is very, at best, rudimentary.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's just the thing to remember is that weather systems are actually huge, right? Even sort of like the biggest atomic weapons we've ever released, like the Russians, they did a 50 megaton release way back. And so that destroyed essentially the surface of an island that was about 20 kilometers across, huge, huge mushroom cloud and so on. But even that is still smaller than really big weather systems, right? So unfortunately, there's not a lot we can do.
Bill, the answer to your question is pretty much no. There's not much we can do about it.
I find that hard to believe, right? Must be something we can go up there to disperse that or change it.
I mean, so the one thing that we have done is we've figured out ways of, again, we can create rain a little bit. We can see clouds with silver iodide. But again, that's only something we can do on small scales, because to create a big rainfall, you've got to do it over enormous area. Yeah.
Perhaps one day, you know, technology might take us down that road, Mr. Mont, but right now.
Sorry.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Still on the weather. I don't know if you saw the tweet from the Nova Scotia Emergency Management Office on the weekend. Just an aside here.
No, the thing that I saw over the weekend was the Pickering non-emergency.
No, this was a tweet from the EMO here in Nova Scotia about the weather. And basically it goes on to say mixed rain and a quick change in temperatures likely this weekend. 10 to 15 centimeters of ice and snow on the north regions. Risk of major freezing rain accumulation in the Annapolis Valley and central and eastern regions. Here's the kicker. Rain should spread over the province Saturday night. The rain will then change into a mix of freezing rain and ice cream on Sunday.
That's why people were tweeting, I'm still waiting for my ice cream.
Waiting for their ice cream.
Oh, got it now.
There was a mix-up, I guess, translation from French to English. And mix of rain will then change into a mix of freezing rain and ice cream on Sunday.
So. Okay, that's cute. Okay.
Indeed. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. You can also send us a question via email, rick.howe@news957.com, or even tweet us a question, our Twitter handle, @TheRickHowe Show. But let me talk some more about some space news, where, the headline, New Research Finds Jupiter Is Flinging Asteroids at Earth.
It's another death from above story.
So what the heck's going on here,
Doctor? So this one is interesting. I actually think this is a little bit overblown, but anyway, and I can do that as an astronomer who kind of understands a number of the issues. So the argument is that Jupiter has a really strong gravitational field. And so as something comes past Jupiter, like a comet, an asteroid, or whatever, Jupiter will actually deflect its path because its gravitational field is that strong. And so I think it's something like 400 times stronger than the Earth, or the mass is 400 times the Earth. And so if you have a whole bunch of things going through the solar system, as happens, right, there are asteroids, there are comets, and so on, then as they encounter Jupiter, they are, the term we use is scattered by Jupiter. Right. And so for a long period of time, the viewpoint of astronomers was, well, you know, on the basis of how small the inner solar system is compared to the outsize of the outer solar system, on average, Jupiter is going to scatter things away. It's kind of protecting us in a way. And so what this particular paper, which is based upon some simulations that were done a while ago, is saying, well, you know, we looked at this and actually, you know, sometimes it kind of throws things towards the inner solar system. Which is exactly what you would expect, yeah. Right? So if you scatter things, you don't sort of like, in general, scatter in one given direction. You'll throw them all over the place. So every now and again, when something is scattered by Jupiter, it's actually going to get sent in towards the inner solar system. So, and in that sense, yes, Jupiter will, every now and again, throw things towards the Earth and Mars and Venus and so on.
And right? We're told these things could be a threat someday.
Yeah, I mean, inevitably there is enough stuff out there that sooner or later there is going to be something that comes in our direction that is some kind of threat. But as a general sort of classification of what Jupiter's role is in this, I would sort of like debate fairly seriously whether in general its activity is to throw things towards the Earth. I think it's just generally should be viewed as throwing things in a general direction, and every now and again things will actually zoom in towards the Earth.
Yeah, I'm reading here a quote from Jonty Horner, an astronomer at the University of Southern Queensland in Australia. He says, quote, "It takes things that threaten Earth and flings them away, clearing space near our planet. So that, in a sense, it's something of a shield. On the flip side, though, it takes things that come nowhere near the Earth and flings them our way, meaning it's also a threat." So it's a little bit of both.
Okay, there we go. That's exactly what I've been saying.
Yeah.
You know, I might actually know a thing or two about this.
Yeah, I think it sounds like you might know a thing or two. By the way, Daryl just emailed to say, hurricanes, tornadoes, and earthquakes, you can't mess with Mother Nature, and you can't fix Trump either.
I would not like to lump Trump in with Mother Nature, but there we go.
Jacques, good morning to you.
Well, good morning, Rick. How are you?
I'm doing well, sir. How are you today?
Very well, very well.
Yep.
We got rid of the snow, but I have a question for the doctor, if
sure.
I may.
Yep, fire away.
In reference to the Earth's magnetic field.
Okay.
Now, on your previous caller, a couple of callers prior, you had mentioned that, you know, in reference to the Earth's magnetic field, that it might reverse and the polarity would, you know, the compass would go awry. How would that affect a magnetometer?
How would that affect a magnetometer? Well, if the magnetometer is measuring both the field strength and the field direction, then as the magnetic field of the Earth changes, it's going to follow that change, right? I mean, that's...
It'll follow the change.
Yeah.
Like, when I was in the Air Force, we used to chase Soviet submarines in the Atlantic, and we had the MAD system, right? And, you know, the MAD was the magnetic anomaly detector, and it was at 45 degrees to the Earth's magnetic field. Now, with the reverse that you were talking about, would that affect the orientation of the magnetic anomaly detector?
So what is the anomaly precisely? Is that a dip angle or what? I don't know.
It detected the obviously, the anomaly in the Earth's magnetic field, like you put a massive piece of metal and pushing it through the Earth's magnetic field, and we had that system that would actually detect that. And we can measure the distance in depth and the frequency in seconds or milliseconds, and we can actually identify, you know, the depth of the submarine.
Well, I've looked it up. So... Geophysics and magnetic anomaly is a local variation in the Earth's magnetic field, right? And so that's resulting from local variations. And so, right? So you'll have variations in the magnetic field. The best way to put it is you would have to recalibrate your magnetic anomaly measurements, right? Because what you will get is you will get what happens locally on top of what's happening globally. So you just have to recalibrate the whole idea of what's happening locally. That's going to stay the same, but the field lines that are coming through from the global field, that's going to change. So you'd have to just recalibrate everything, I think.
We'd have to recalibrate, yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Well, that would probably have to be a new system because these things are already built at 45 degrees to the Earth's magnetic field, right?
Okay.
All right. John.
Well, thank you very much, Rick, and Doctor, much appreciated for your time.
Appreciate the call. Thanks very much. 10:28 is the time right now. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. If you've got a question for Dr. Thacker here this morning, give us a call. David just tweeted, by the way, he said, should have went to Nova Scotia on Sunday. Always loved ice cream, he writes here. 10:28, we're going to break for a news update, then more Science Files. We're back right after the news. coming up now to 10:33 here on this Monday morning. Dr. Rob Thacker is with us in the studio here this hour. It's time for Science Files, and if you've got a question for the doctor, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. He's an astrophysicist at St. Mary's University. Let's talk a bit about plastic recycling here.
Yep.
We know that we had an issue when China stopped buying much of our plastics. It began to stockpile in our warehouses and such. And now we found, it seems, an alternative here. A local company out in Goodwood, in fact, is now taking some of our plastics and converting it into furniture like picnic tables and such. Is this a good thing, Dr. Rob, or no?
I think you've got to look at this in a number of ways. And so it's sort of like what we would call zeroth order, like when we have first order, second order, third order, and so on. So as a fundamental idea of taking the stuff that would otherwise go into a landfill and reusing it, it's a good idea.
Yeah.
Right?
But there's a but, right?
And there is a but. And so the issue with plastics is... you can't recycle them indefinitely like you can, say, metals, right? You heat metals up, you just remake whatever you want, right? But with plastics, you can't do that. The polymers degrade over a while, and eventually they don't have the structural integrity, and so you can't use them. So that's a concern. You can't do this continually. The other thing with plastics is the whole microplastic thing that we've talked about before, right? The key thing with plastics is they don't degrade, right? In the same way as like a piece of wood, a piece of paper does, right? There are not many things in nature that will degrade a plastic. And so even if you have that plastic, it's like the people who, Patagonia, right? So Patagonia is a clothing company. They said, we're going to get really green. We're going to use recycled fleece from plastic water bottles, right? And they thought, oh, this is great. This is like us saving the planet as best as we can. And then people started realizing that, you know, all of these fleeces were releasing these microplastic fibers when they were washed, right? And those were going through the sewer systems and out into the system. So with any kind of plastic, you always have this microplastic issue that it's basically material that's getting out into the ecosystem, whether you like it or not. So at a zeroth level, then yes, it's a good idea. But the fact of the matter remains is there are issues with plastics that recycling them isn't going to take away. Right. And that's something that we all need to remember.
But these plastic furniture that this company is producing, they'll last forever, will they not?
Well, for certainly the thick planks will last a long time, for sure. But the point would be, like, you go and scuff them up and so on, you're still creating microplastics in the environment.
Yeah. And again, these are the little
tiny slivers of plastic. I mean, I will say that in general, this is better than, like, as I said, this is better than putting it in a landfill, right? For sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Right,
but the best solution is
as a society we have to get off plastics as best we can.
Yeah, and we're heading down that direction.
Yeah, we are.
But we still rely very much on plastics. Look at the wrap you see in the grocery stores or consumer products that you buy in the department stores. And the amount of plastic that goes on these things is absolutely outrageous.
And so we've talked about this before. By 2050, if we carry on polluting the oceans of the planet the same way that we are right now, there will be more plastic pollution in the oceans
than fish.
Than biota.
Yeah.
Right.
Than what?
Biota, all of the things that live in the
all
ocean.
All of the things, okay. Yeah. What are you laughing at over there, Katie?
Using those science terms.
Yeah, using your science term and my ignorance about that science term. 10:37 is the time. Bobby Ryan with a question here from email this morning. He says, can you explain how the majority of impact craters you see on the moon look to be a straight impact rather than a glancing blow like when we skip a stone on the water?
That's a good question. So my understanding is, for most impact craters, even at sort of like a 20 or 30 degree angle, you will still get something that looks roughly circular, right? Because it's the surface of the planet that matters, not the particular angle that comes in. So whether you come in from straight down, whether you come in from the side, you get pretty much a circular crater. But as you go shallower and shallower and shallower, then you will get things where you do actually get sort of like multiple sort of like skipping events and things like that. And so there are evidence for those things, right, on the moon itself. In fact, if you look at a big crater field, you can usually find sort of like slightly elongated craters within that field.
Okay.
Okay. My understanding.
Well, that's good as an explanation as I've ever heard. 10:38 is the time. Let's talk about women pioneering in the world of science. Mm-hmm. And her name is Vera Rubin.
Oh, awesome.
She's going to be honored for her work in observing the anomalous motion of stars. And apparently she was
That's
also...
another way of saying dark matter.
Is that what I was just going to say? Dark matter here. Yeah. Tell me about this lady. Is she Canadian, American?
She's American. So Vera Rubin is a bit of an absolute star, if I can use that, in astronomy. So she was responsible for essentially determining that there is dark matter within galaxies. And so she did this by looking at the speed that stars rotate around the galaxy. And what she basically argued was that, you know, if all of the stuff that we can see is there, then the stars are traveling too fast. Too fast. We think there is more things that are actually there that are keeping the stars traveling around. And so people have said, well, you know, maybe the law of gravity is wrong on large scales or something like that. People still debate that. It's really hard to make that work accurately, although there's a few people who do work very hard in trying to do that. But in general, the accepted hypothesis is that this means that there is dark matter within galaxies. And so Vera Rubin is strongly credited with being one of the fundamental discoverers of evidence for dark matter. And in fact, there was a big debate over whether she should have got the Nobel Prize before she passed away. She passed away a couple of years ago, I believe.
Yeah, her work was back in the 60s, right?
Late 60s, 70s, yeah. And so she was an awesome individual. Worked in had a number of issues in her career as a woman in a field dominated by men, but nonetheless did this amazing work, very, very detailed work, and should, in my opinion, have received the Nobel Prize, but unfortunately she didn't. Hmm. The one thing to be aware of is that there was an astronomer in the 1930s, Fritz Zwicky, who looked at the motions of galaxies within clusters of galaxies, and he used that to infer the presence of dark matter before Vera had done her work. But nonetheless, there's multiple sort of like pieces of evidence for dark matter, and she, along with Kent Ford and Ken Freeman, probably the three people who arguably could have been credited with finding dark matter in galaxies or evidence for dark matter in galaxies. It's very difficult to find dark matter. We still don't know what it is. We still don't know absolutely for sure that it's there, but there's a ton of evidence that it is.
She's being honored by having a large telescope now being constructed in the mountains of Chile, named after her. It'll be the Vera C. Rubin Observatory.
Yep. So this is what has been known as the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, or LSST, for a long time. And so this is a really amazing project because it takes the idea of what a telescope does and kind of flips it on its head. Because we tend to think of a telescope as being something that makes very distant things much bigger. What this telescope does is it actually takes a very, very big picture, several times the full moon. But because it's so big, it gets down to seeing very, very, very faint things very, 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 very quickly. All right. And so what it will do is it will take an image of the whole sky every 3 days. And then we're literally, if you want to use this kind of an analogy, we'll literally be creating a movie of the southern sky.
Wow.
Right. So it will do this in Chile. And so why is that interesting? Because now we're going to be bringing in a whole era of being able to see how the sky changes, how the whole southern sky changes. So this is something that people who work in so-called transient astronomy have been waiting for decades for. And it's just getting ready. It should be going about 2021. So this is something that the American astronomy community made their number one priority in 2010 to finish. And so seeing this finished is a really, really big thing. And I would say calling it the Rubin Telescope is a really, really good name as well.
Says here she was also an outspoken advocate and role model for women in science.
Absolutely.
Where are we at today in regards to that? Is it still very much an old boys club? Or?
So where we are seeing women get into science on more and more levels, but where we're seeing problems are in things like career progression, because women still obviously want to have kids and things like that. So they need to be able to take time out with people saying, oh yeah, you took time out and so you weren't really committed and so on. We need that kind of viewpoint to be eradicated completely and then give women who come into the field a chance to basically carry on in their career on the basis of what they'd done before taking that time off. That's something that's, I think, come in fairly well. But there are also hidden biases against women. And there's even evidence that women can be biased against other women as well, right? So being aware of this is really important. And so we've done studies looking at how a new generation of women coming through, assistant professor would then moved to associate professor and then full professor, and they're still not transitioning as fast as we would expect, right? So we still think there are hidden biases, well, not so hidden biases in many cases, within the system that need to be addressed. It's getting better, but there's still a lot more work to be done.
Right? Dan just emailed to say, don't forget Henrietta Leavitt, the brains he writes behind Edwin Hubble.
Yeah, Henrietta Leavitt. Yep.
Leavitt, was it?
Yeah, Leavitt. Okay. Yeah.
But more and more women are getting involved in science.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you look at very often undergraduate and graduate schools, it's in many fields more women than men in some sciences. So psychology, I think, is one example of that. So, yeah.
All right. 10:43. Bob, stay there. You're coming up. We've got lines open. If you've got a question for Dr. Rob here this morning, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. One of the topics coming up is the most realistic plant-based steak yet, or so they say. But listen to the ingredients. Well, we'll tell the ingredients.
Num.
Yeah, I'm not sure when you hear the ingredients if you'll go num. 10:44, back with more Science Falls right after this. 10:46 on a Monday morning Science Falls with Dr. Rob, and Bob's on the phone with us with a question or a comment this morning. Hi, Bob.
How are you doing, guys?
We're doing fine,
good,
sir.
Thanks, Bob.
How are you?
I haven't talked to you in a long time.
Mm. Yep.
I got some mysteries going on in my research.
All right.
Uh-oh.
I've been following a lot of NOVA programs concerning the Hubble. I mean, there's a lot out there.
Yeah, there sure is.
And it's beautiful, too, because I just seen the Hubble and what they're doing in the future with the new program. It's fantastic.
James Webb?
But there's still one mystery that's driving me crazy.
What's that?
Mm-hmm.
Black holes.
Okay.
Is there another universe or what? I mean, it's going somewhere.
Okay.
And it's not coming out anywhere.
Okay. Bob, I can't give you the answer that you want. And the short answer is you can never actually know, right? Because to know whether black holes connect to another universe, you actually have to go into the black hole. And once you've gone into the black hole,
see you later.
You can't tell anyone back in the universe that you came from. So you can never actually know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, would that... I'm going way out on this one. I noticed that they found water 27 million light years away.
Okay.
Now, we'll never send back what happened if we're on our way there, but we're going to go there someday, aren't we?
Maybe.
We're going to go and search the universe. Because that's in our, and we're on that path to get out there, because that's why we have telescopes. That's why we're searching the universe, because we want to find out if there's life out there. Well, naturally, there is life out there.
I would disagree slightly. I would say we research the universe because we want to know what's out there, not necessarily whether we're going to go there. Because some of those galaxies are so far away that we will never get there.
I
the stars are pretty darn far away as well. I mean, they're going to be tough to get to, period.
I think the human brain, as I spoke about before, is going to be special in the future. I think there's a lot in the human brain that, we're missing. And I'm working on that now.
Good for you, Bob.
Maybe you could volunteer, Bob, to be the first human to go into a black hole, and you could tell us all about it when you come back, if you come back.
You can't come
back. Well, I just wanted to get... with a good communication company. I mean, I don't care. If it's better on the other side, I'll go.
Appreciate the call, Bob. Thanks very much, buddy. 10:49.
Stop wanting to send your callers into black holes.
Sorry. Let's talk about plant food and plant-based steak. This plant-based food is becoming more and more popular.
Yeah.
And we're starting to see like plant-based sausage now that's being offered. But
yeah, there's a plant-based pork because pork is the most popular meat in the world.
Yeah. But this is a story out of The Guardian that's headlined, The Most Realistic Plant-Based Steak Revealed. Mm-hmm. And it's what says here, the fake steak, I like that, the fake steak's ingredients include peas, seaweed, and beetroot juice.
Among other things.
If you're trying to make this appetizing, That doesn't sound like a very appetizing combination.
Well, I mean, if you didn't know, I mean, what's going to determine how interesting this is to people is basically how it looks when you cook it and then how it tastes when you eat it, right? Yeah. So the list of ingredients, whatever. I mean, it's kind of fun to joke about, but at the end of the day, how does it taste? And so the key challenge in all of this is making something that has a similar texture. That's been the real challenge. And so the key thing in this is creating extruded, sort of like cellular type fake meats that feel like real meats when you sort of chew on them and so on. And so getting those extruded chains has been the really challenging thing. And it's taken companies a fair amount of time to do that. And so having tried sort of like Beyond Burger, Beyond Meat stuff and so on, it's a reasonable facsimile of meat.
But what's the point?
What is the point? And so I think the point is to give people who really like the texture and taste of meat something that is vegan. I mean, there are reasonable arguments that we could cut down on greenhouse gas emissions by a fair amount by reducing the number of livestock that we have. So that won't solve climate change by any sense, but it would contribute a reasonable amount to moving us towards a better environment solution. But at the end of the day, this is about, I think, my viewpoint is this is about giving people something that is essentially plant-based. They can try it. They can go, okay, that's all right. And then you can get them onto the next thing, like a black bean burger or a portobello burger or something like that. Because those things, and I'll say this as someone who I still eat meat, but I'll eat other things as well, such as plant-based burgers with black bean burgers and so on. And if you've ever had a good one, they're really, really good.
So you've had good ones, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And we were talking about this just before I came on. So my wife and I, we went up to New Brunswick. We went to the Tide and Boar in Moncton.
Yep.
And they had a black bean. And that is one of the best burgers of any type I've ever had, right? And so you just have to give it a chance, though. And so this is a way of giving people who don't normally eat burgers something to try, eat vegetarian burgers, something to try that is plant-based. And then they can go from there. And I think that's the role that this will probably play in the big scheme of things. There are, of course, people who will probably just want to carry on eating something that feels and tastes like meat.
Mm.
Okay, c'est la vie. But nonetheless, I think that the way this is going to really play out is as a stepping stone to other types of.
It says here, the enormous impact of cattle and other livestock on the environment has led a swath of companies to create these plant-based alternatives to meat. With Beyond Meat Burger starting things off. That had the whole thing rolling, right?
We're going to see more and more of this. We'll see, as I said, the CES 2020, they were talking about a pork version of pork that was plant-based. So we'll see how that takes off as well.
All right, back to the phones are going. Jim's on the line with a question for us this morning. Hi, Jim.
Morning.
Morning.
I have a question. Years ago, you used to be able to visit the St. Mary's Telescope on Saturday nights. Is that still an option, or is there any place else to look
for
a professional telescope?
But the bad news is, since we did the renovation of the observatory, we've had sellouts for now 4 years in a row.
Really?
So what you can do is, if you go on the internet and you search for Burke Gaffney Observatory, and then you can go onto our, that will show you a link, you can go to our page on our home website, and you can reserve tickets for the Saturday night open houses there. They're free. We're not charging people. But what tends to happen is, if we can't run the open house, then all those people who couldn't get in, as soon as the next batch of tickets come up, they log on and grab them as quick as they can. And so there's basically a whole bunch of people who are looking to get them. So we do our best to keep running the open houses, and we do them basically every month or so. Some situations a little bit more often than that. But it's challenging to get tickets. Hot ticket.
There you go.
So you mean it's sold 4 years out?
since we did it in 2014, it's been very busy since then. But give it a go is all I can say.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Good try. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it. Let's go next to Ken here this morning. Hi, Ken.
Hi, guys. My brother is going to Australia end of the month. By the way, it's round trip from Toronto to Perth. It was $6,000 when I was going to go 10 years ago. My brother got a seat deal, $3,700. Pretty good.
Yeah, not bad.
And of course, he's worried about the fires and climate change. I'm just amazed at the persistence of the deniers of climate change. The Australian Prime Minister is infamous for bringing a piece of coal into the parliament and saying, this doesn't hurt anybody.
Oh, have you seen the cartoons? Like, there's this amazing cartoon of him being surrounded by fire and having a bucket of coal and saying, this should put it out, right?
Not at all. Hmm. Yeah, this Australian Prime Minister came from the oil and gas industry, by the way.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's beholden to a number of interests.
You have a question, Ken, because we're running out of time here, bud.
Yeah, the question is climate change. Rob, why do you believe humans cause climate change is real? Thanks very much, guys.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Ken.
I don't believe. I trust the balance of evidence as compiled by the research done by the IPCC panel, which is basically 400 to 500 of the best climate scientists in the world working together, reviewing the literature of thousands of scientists on this topic, right? And that's why humans have created climate change.
Yes, indeed. And if we don't do something about it soon, anyway. Here's just to end the hour with the segment with a little talk here about a Japanese billionaire. His name is Yasaku Maezawa. He plans to go fly around the moon in 2023.
One who's got the ticket with SpaceX.
Yeah,
right?
Elon Musk group there. Yeah. But he wants to bring along a girlfriend. So he's got an open competition, I guess we'll call it. Looking for a girlfriend to accompany him on his trip around the moon. Applications, by the way, close on January 17th. And then he'll select his partner by the end of March. But how much is this guy paying to go fly around the moon, do you know?
I don't think the amount was ever released. My guess would be it's at least $50 million, if not considerably more.
Yikes. Well, that's why only billionaires, I guess, would be able to afford. So if any lonely women out there would like to go on a trip around the moon...
You can just sing the song, can you? Fly me to the moon.
And a critical comment here from Alan as we end the hour. He said that I say the ingredients of the new plant-based steak don't sound appetizing. What about the idea, he says, that ripping out a piece of bloody disgusting muscle tissue from the limb of an animal and then throwing it on a fire is somehow more appetizing?
Well, I know there are some people who feel that way, but that doesn't help the climate.
It doesn't. That's right. Dr. Rob, as always, another interesting hour, and appreciate you dropping by again.
A lot of fun, as always. Thanks, everyone. Great questions.
Indeed. See you next week. Dr. Rob Thacker from St. Mary's University. He's an astrophysicist there, and he's with us every Monday at this time for Science Files. Right now, though, 2 minutes before 11 o'clock, we're going to break for an news update coming up shortly. Then it's your turn to sound off this morning. We've got our first open hour of the week coming up next hour. We call it Manic Monday, and anything goes in the next hour. And, well, all you have to do is give us a call. Our lines await your calls now at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll take your calls after the news, and the news is coming up next.